Steiner thought for a bit, then said, I know family people for a half dozen guys who are connected. I guess I'd call up those family people, tell them to get in touch with their man, and tell their guy to have Gar call me. Somebody would probably be able to make a connection or know how to get a connection made.
Would one of those calls be going to Sturgill? Steiner's head came up. Sturgill, darling? Is he in this? Could be, Lucas said, keeping his face straight. Sturgill, darling.
How many could there be?
Steiner looked away again, muttered something unintelligible, then said, Well, that makes a little more sense then. How? Steiner said. Sturgill's mostly a setup man, or used to be. He made his money spotting jobs. When Marilyn told me about Gar's drug job, I kind of wondered how he got onto them. Gar's not real big on spotting. He's bigger on the actual doing. Where would I find Sturgill? Don't know. I've heard he's got a farm down in Alabama. He's like an actual tractor driver. Gar once told me that Sturgill's hometown is so small the laundromat has a clothesline.
How did you get in touch with him to get him to come to your party up in Nashville? I'd see him around, Steiner said. We all used to hang out on Lower Broadway in Nashville, going to clubs. I ran into him and said, come on over. Marilyn tell you about that? Marilyn told me almost nothing, Lucas said. Then how'd you track me? Lucas dug in his jacket pocket, produced his phone, and held it up. You know why they call them cell phones? 'Cause people who use them wind up in cells. I'll remember that, Steiner said. What are you gonna do with me? Tell the FBI exactly where you are, but I'll wait a while. An hour, maybe. I'm gonna give you my cell number. If those hitters, whoever they are, catch up with you, they'll skin you alive. That's the honest-to-God truth, John. That's what they'll do. The Tennessee cops are keeping an eye on your sister, but they can't do that forever. It's possible these people will be going back to her, if we don't take them out first. So, buy another burner phone, call up who you have to, figure out how you can get in touch with Gar. When you find out, don't call him. Call me. Gar will never know. What if he calls me instead? Then call and tell me about it. We can figure out where the call came from, Lucas said. Steiner looked away. I don't know, man. You told me what would happen if you go to jail. Ah, shit. Give me your number, Steiner said. Lucas ripped a page out of his notebook, scribbled his cell phone number on it, and said, Call me as soon as you get that burner. If I were you, I'd clear out of here, and right quick. I gotta tell the feds that I found you, but I'll give you 3 steps. And, John, don't make me find you again. Give me 3 steps, like they say in the song. Steiner looked around the shop. The paint-shedding walls, the flaking acoustic tile on the ceiling, the plastic light fixture, the yellowing business cards, and lost cat notices on the bulletin board. Best goddamn job I ever had, he said. I was like in management. Chapter 10. When Lucas left Steiner, he called Fort in Washington, arranged to get an airline ticket back to Nashville, and filled him in on Sturgill Darling. That's the guy I need, Lucas said. There's a chance that he's the one who spotted the Biloxi counting house, and even if he didn't, there's still a chance he knows where Poole is hiding. He could be the planner, the spotter. You got the name, and it's unusual. Get me an address. Fort said he'd get that going, and added, I got a call back from Louise on your travel. You've got a ticket back to Nashville, but you gotta hurry. Lucas's next call was to the FBI. He told them that he'd spoken to Steiner but hadn't had time for an arrest and the processing. If you really want him, he's probably still around. We made some calls about him. We don't want him all that much, but if we get a break, we'll go over and pick him up, the AIC said. Lucas said good riddance to the Jeep at Hertz, checked his bag and the 45 with Southwest. He hadn't taken the training for law enforcement officers flying armed, so couldn't carry aboard, and made it to the gate early enough to buy an Esquire Black Book magazine and a Snickers bar. 2 hours after he left Steiner, he was sweating at the back of the plane, holding tight to the armrests during takeoff. When they survived that and got up in the air, he managed to relax enough to open the magazine. By the time he finished working through the men's fashion articles and discovered he'd need a new suite of neckties, they were descending into Nashville, and he was sweating again. On the ground, he found an email from Washington. They had a rural address for a Sturgill Darling outside the small town of Elkmont, Alabama, not more than an hour and a half from where he was. The location was right, as Poole's pals seemed to come from the greater Nashville area. He could drive halfway there, bag out in the same motel where he'd been the night before, have a leisurely dinner and a nice breakfast, and still get to Elkmont before 10 o'clock. He also had a text message with a new phone number for Steiner. So far, so good. When Lucas walked out the door at the coffee corner, Steiner, suffused with gloom, finished the Pabst and threw the bottle toward the trash can. He missed and it shattered on the concrete floor. He didn't bother to sweep up. He fished the last 3 bottles of PBR and 2 Cokes out of the refrigerator, looked around the office, got his baseball cap, and walked down the street to his apartment. The apartment had come furnished, and while initially it had smelled strange, his own personal odors had taken over in the 6 months that he'd had the job, and now it felt like home. No option, though. Maybe Davenport hadn't been telling the truth and the feds were on the way to pick him up, but maybe he had been telling the truth and Steiner had some time. Over the next hour, he moved his personal possessions into the camper back of his aging Ford Ranger, said goodbye to the apartment, left a message for the owner, and took off. As he was passing a swamp, he threw his phone out the window. In the next hour and a half, he acquired 2 new prepaid phones, one from Walmart and the other from Best Buy. A while later, as Lucas was bracing for the crash landing at Nashville, Steiner took out one of the new phones and punched in a number from memory. He didn't get a recorded message, just a beep. After the beep, he said, A270 is way better on Deer. Call me on this number and soon. I'm serious, man. Darling called back 10 minutes later. He asked, Better than what? Better than a 243. Long time no hear, Darling said. What's up? You could be in deep shit. By the way, this is a brand new prepaid phone I'm gonna throw away in the next 5 minutes, so you can't call me back. I was visited by a U.S. Marshal, and he was asking after you by name in connection with a major job, Steiner said. He knew you'd been a party at my place years ago. I told him I didn't know where you live now or what your phone number might be. I said I just knew you from hanging around Lower Broadway. What exactly did he say? Steiner laid it out. About the murders of Poole's parents, about the 2 killers who'd started working over his sister. Somehow they got you know whose name and they're looking for him. They're going after anyone who knows about him. I told this fed I didn't know anything about it, that I hadn't seen any of you for years. Anyway, the marshal's looking for you. He really wants your friend, but he doesn't know how to get to him. Damn it. And you say these greasers are looking for my friend? It's like a race.
Your friend would do well to get far out of town, right away, and not tell anybody where he's going. But that wouldn't stop the greasers from looking, would it? If they get my name, they could be all over my family. I hadn't worked it out that far, Steiner said. I don't know your situation there, but they didn't stop at torturing anyone else's family. If they find somebody else who knows that you and your friend were tight, they could be coming. Long silence, then. Anything else? No, except that I'm on the run myself, Steiner said. I got nothing to do with any of this, but I don't want them coming for me. I'm crawling in a hole and pulling the dirt over my head. Tell you what, buddy, Darling said. I owe you. When this all blows over, come and see me. I'll take good care of you. Yeah, well, thank you. I'll check in a year or so, if you're around. They hung up simultaneously, and Steiner waited until there were no headlights on the back of his truck and dropped the phone onto the interstate, where it'd get run over 900 times before daylight. That done, he called Lucas from the other phone, and when Lucas didn't answer, left a text message with his new phone number. Then he turned his truck around and headed south. His thinking was this. The cops would expect him to run, and since he came from the north, they might expect him to go back that way. If they checked the phone call he had made to Davenport, they'd see it came from north of Orlando. He didn't have to run that far, though. Tampa would work. If the marshal ever called him back, he planned to string him along until he had a feel for what to do, and then either run or hold tight. The main thing was, he had to stay away from the two hired killers. The marshal wouldn't be sawing his leg off, whatever else he might do. As he was doing that, Court and Soto were at work on the outskirts of Roswell, Georgia. Court looked into the empty blood-clotted eye sockets of an elderly man named Henry Bedsoe. Bedsoe's eyeballs lay on the floor like a couple of bloody squashed grapes. She shouted, "That's all you got, Sturgill, darling? What kind of a name is that? I don't believe that shit. You got 10 seconds to tell me or I'm gonna rip your motherfucking tongue out by the roots, and then I'm gonna let you drown in your own blood. Who else? I don't believe this darling bullshit. Who else, motherfucker?" Chapter 11. Lucas got a later start than he'd expected the next morning. No problem, he'd just slept late, and the car clock said it was nearly 11 before he rolled down a narrow rural highway to the Darling Farm. The farm stretched across a natural bowl in the land, the bottom land along a river or creek. A twisting line of trees on the far side of the farm marked out the stream. The farm itself had a prosperous, well-groomed industrial air. A neat white single-story house sat on the left, facing the road, a dozen trees spotted around the yard, throwing overlapping circles of shade. A broad, heavily graveled driveway separated the house from a six-slot white metal garage, and at the back ended at a white barn. As far as Lucas could see, there were no animals. The place was purely a grain operation, with soybean fields pressing at the sides and back of the two-acre-sized residential lot. A sliding door was open on the left side of the barn, and he could see the front end of a corn-green John Deere tractor. Farms, in Lucas's experience, which wasn't extensive, usually showed bits of history around the edges. Old chicken coops and machine sheds, maybe a neglected clothesline in the back, abandoned machinery parked in a woodlot. The Darling Farm had none of that. Everything looked new and well-maintained, with rectangular beds of pastel petunias edging the driveway and sidewalks, while marigolds laid a circle of gold at the base of a flagpole in the center of the front yard. A silver propane tank squatted like a huge silver bullet on the far side of the house.
Lucas pulled into the driveway, saw a woman's face checking him from a side door window. He touched the pistol under his jacket, climbed out, walked to the door, and rang the doorbell. The woman opened the door, cocked her head. "You're not the propane guy," she said. She was tall, comfortably heavy, with neatly coiffed blonde hair betrayed by dark eyebrows. She fit the farm.
"I'm a U.S. Marshal," Lucas said. "I need to interview Sturgill Darling about an old friend of his. Is he around?"
The woman had been smiling politely, but now the smile faded.
"It's that damn Garpool, isn't it?"
"Why would you say that?" Lucas asked.
"Because he's the only one I've heard of who'd have a marshal coming by.
Sturgill hasn't talked to him for years."
"But I knew that sooner or later somebody would be coming around looking for him."
She hesitated, then unlocked the screen door between them and pushed it open.
"You better come in if we're going to talk. Sturgill's gone off to Canada on a hunting trip. Won't be back until week after next."
As Lucas stepped inside, Darling watched from the garage. He'd heard Lucas's truck turn in from the road, and he'd called his wife to warn her that somebody was in the driveway and that it might be the law, or it might be the torture crew. If it was the cartel crew, he'd be outside the window with a tactical shotgun. He told her to leave her cell phone turned on and lying on the couch table so he could hear what was going on. The night before, he'd checked the internet for news stories on the pool murders and the assault on Steiner's sister, and had gone into town to call Gar Poole from a payphone to fill him in. Poole had said, "There are only three people who know where I am and how to get in touch. I'll call the others and warn them. You probably ought to get lost for a while. Get the old lady somewhere they can't find her. If we lay low long enough, they'll go away. They can't go running around the countryside cutting people up forever. They'll get caught."
"I'll do that, but I've still got some money here," Darling said. "It's hid, but I need to hide it better. If the cops came in and really tore the place apart and found it, I couldn't explain it. I got some farm work to do, too, but then I'll get out. I'll get back to you with a number on a new burner."
"You might want to skip the farm work and get out," Poole said. "That thing about sawing off my mom's leg, those are not people you want to fuck with."
Darling had almost $2 million in cash at the farm. After getting off the phone, he'd bought a couple of sturdy self-sealing plastic tubs, packed the money inside them, then after dark, carried them across the road to a brushy patch of ground and, with his wife watching, buried them. That done, he'd started cleaning up the barn. He'd been getting the equipment ready to bring in the beans, but now he'd have to put that off. He got the combine back together, called an outfitter he knew in northwestern Ontario, and made arrangements to do some bear hunting. In the morning, he finished cleaning up the barn and had been loading the truck with his hunting and traveling gear when Lucas turned up. He could watch the house from a corner window. Janice was a smart woman and would be okay with a lawman, he thought. In case the very worst happened and the big man in the suit wasn't the law at all, he waited with the shotgun in his hand.
The woman introduced herself to Lucas as Janice Darling, Sturgill's wife.
She took Lucas to sit in the living room and offered him a glass of water or a Diet Coke, and he accepted the Coke. After she'd settled into the chair opposite him, Lucas told her about the robbery in Biloxi and the apparent response by the cartel, including the murder of the Pools and the assault on Marilyn Campbell. Janice knew all of that, but pretended that she was hearing it for the first time.
"My God," she said, "they did that because they thought maybe these people knew where Gar Poole is. Are they coming for us? We've got 4 children. They're all grown up, but they could be found."
"I don't know if they're coming for you or not, but it's not a risk you should take, especially with your husband gone," Lucas said.
He'd been watching her closely as he told the story and had seen her eyes glaze. She'd heard it before, he thought.
She was lying. Sturgill Darling was probably somewhere close by.
If he was gone hunting in Canada, he'd probably just left. It might, he thought, be worth hanging around, somewhere out of sight, to see if Darling appeared. If Janice Darling knew anything about Gar Pool or the Biloxi robbery, she was stonewalling.
I can tell you that Sturgill has nothing to do with those people, at least their criminal activities, and never did.
He did used to play some guitar up in Nashville and hung out on Broadway, but that didn't go anywhere, and he came back here. That's where he knew them from, and that's the last he's seen of them. He's been farming for 20 years since then. Lucas asked her to call her husband, but she said he didn't have a cell phone. He didn't believe that either. As they were talking, Court and Soto pulled to the shoulder on a hillside road a quarter mile away, looking down a bluff toward the farm in the green valley below. A creek meandered across the landscape, lined with trees. Soto didn't know shit about trees, and Court was no better. Off in the distance, a couple of farms away, a train was rolling by like a bunch of golden caterpillars racing to lunch. The farm itself was a tidy rectangle. The row crops were dark green and low, with some of the leaves turning to gold as autumn crept into the south. And off to the right, at an adjacent farm, a couple of dozen rough acres were given over to pasturage, on which they could see two dark brown horses.
"That sort of looks like cotton down there, but I don't think it is," Court muttered. "Don't know what it might be, though. Can't be corn. Corn's taller."
"It's wheat,"
Soto said of the soybeans.
"Yeah. Don't know about that. Never seen any wheat or oats."
Soto's head bobbed, and he said,
"I can tell you one thing about Tennessee farmers for sure."
"We're in Alabama," Court said.
"Same exact thing," Soto said irritably. "Anyway, one thing about Tennessee or Alabama farmers is they'll have a gun handy in the stairwell. Somebody breaks into your house, won't be any cop close enough to save your ass. They got guns like that kid in Franklin and Old Man Poole."
Court shifted uncomfortably. She was sitting on a soft donut pillow intended for hemorrhoid sufferers, and while it helped, her ass still felt like she'd been hit with a baseball bat and she was still seeping some blood into the Kotexes they were now using as bandages.
"What are you saying here?"
Soto had a cinnamon-flavored toothpick rolling around in his mouth and stopped to pick out some obstruction in his lower jawline.
"I'm not saying we can't do it. I'm just saying we gotta be careful. We're not dealing with some street kids here. These guys are hardcore criminals."
"Who must be doing well," Court said. "That looks like a Ben sitting in the driveway."
"Well, we know we're looking for a few suitcases full of $100 bills. A Benz is small change."
"Fuck it, then. Let's do it," Court said.
Soto pulled on a pair of silvered sunglasses and put the car in gear. Lucas had gotten one valuable thing from the interview with Janice Darling. The couch table had an array of family photographs on it, including several with a husky middle-aged man that Lucas thought must be Sturgill Darling. Darling with Janice Darling, the two of them posed with three girls of elementary, middle school, and finally high school age, a photo of Janice and Sturgill on a big-game fishing boat with a boy who showed Sturgill's cheekbones and smile. If Lucas ran into Sturgill Darling, he'd recognize him. A half hour after he'd arrived, Lucas picked up his legal pad and pen and was about to thank her for her time when they both heard another car crunch up the gravel drive. Darling frowned and asked,
"Now who could that be? I'm not expecting anyone."
She and Lucas both stood and looked out the living room window. A blue Toyota had pulled up behind Lucas's truck, and a heavyset woman was climbing out. She looked around, then reached into the car to pick something up. When she turned, she had a clipboard in her hand. Lucas turned to Darling and asked, "Do you have a gun in the house?"
"What?
A gun? Do you have a gun in the house?"
"A shotgun in the mudroom," she said.
"Run and get it, then get in a bathroom, load it, and point the gun at the door, and don't come out until you hear me yell for you." Darling looked at the woman outside, who was headed toward the side door.
"You think?"
"Almost for sure," Lucas said. "Now go, go!" She hurried off to the back of the house. Lucas pulled out his .45 and jacked a shell into the chamber and went to the door. He pulled it open as the woman was about to climb onto the bottom step. He couldn't see her right hand, which was under the clipboard. He pointed the .45 at her chest and said, "Get back, get back, get on the ground." She was surprised, but instead of protesting, she stepped backward and sideways, and Lucas followed her with his eyes and then snapped his head back toward the car where he saw the far door opening. A moment later, a man stepped around the door and lifted a rifle over the hood of the car. Lucas didn't quite think rifle, but the idea was there, and he threw himself back into the house, and a split second later, a burst of a half-dozen slugs tore through the closing screen door as he dropped and rolled to his left and then scrambled to the living room window. The walls of the house were almost no barrier to the bullets punching through the aluminum siding and interior drywall, but the shooter was making the mistake of sweeping the outside wall at waist level while Lucas was rolling across the living room carpet to a window in the corner. Another burst of bullets punched through the kitchen walls at the other end of the house, and Lucas risked standing up and then stepping in front of the window. He didn't bother breaking the glass, but simply opened fire on the man behind the car, the window blowing out as he fired. To his left, the heavyset woman had gotten back to the car and was running around the backside. Lucas had missed the man behind the car, and the rifle turned toward him, and he dropped again as a gust of slugs blew through the window. The guy behind the car had a fully automatic weapon, which was not surprising, but created an awkward situation for a cop armed with a handgun. Lucas rolled back toward the door and kicked it open and emptied the rest of the magazine at the car. The man popped up again, beside the driver's side door, shooting over the roof now, and Lucas rolled the other direction this time, as more shots pounded through the door and the siding around the door, and crawled behind an antique Hammond organ that sat behind a side window. He slammed a second magazine into the .45, then peeked out the window. The woman was sitting in the driver's seat, and the man had the rifle propped on the roof of the car, apparently waiting for any motion. Then the car was moving, and the man jumped in the back seat, and the car screeched in reverse out toward the road. Lucas stepped to the door, and as the car made a clumsy backing turn onto the highway, he emptied the .45 into it, saw both the driver's side and the back windows blow out. But the car accelerated away. The guy with the rifle fired a burst through the broken-out back window of the car, and Lucas dodged back inside. The car was 300 or 400 yards away when Lucas ran out to the bends and threw it in a circle out to the highway and followed. He didn't have to catch them. He only had to keep them in sight. Catching them, in fact, would be stupid. He had nothing that would contend with a machine gun. He had two reserve magazines in the locked center console, and he managed to unlock it as he rolled down the gravel driveway and fished the magazines out. The Toyota was perhaps a half mile ahead when he made it onto the highway and started after it. He would sweat about it later, but wasn't yet frightened. He was angry and excited and focused on running down the Toyota. He needed to stay in touch, and he needed help. Fort was at work in Washington. The secretary answered his phone, and Lucas screamed at her, and Fort came up, and Lucas sputtered, "I'm chasing the cartel guys, one male, one female. I'm a half minute behind them on a highway outside the town of Elkmont, Alabama. I need you to get onto the sheriff's office, whatever it is here, and have them call me, and I'll vector them in." He'd closed the distance since he'd turned out of the driveway, and up ahead the Toyota braked and then made a hard right turn onto a dirt side road and started up a hill. Lucas would have the advantage there with a hefty four-wheel drive, unless... the unless happened. He was halfway up the hill, the Toyota having disappeared over the crest of the hill, when he saw the rim of blue off to one side. The Toyota had stopped, and the rifleman was waiting, the gun again braced over the top of the car. Lucas jabbed the brakes and dropped sideways onto the passenger seat when the windshield blew out, raining broken glass on his face, neck, and arms. He crawled over the center console as more rifle slugs pelted the front of the car and pushed the passenger side door, intending to drop onto the ground, where he'd be sheltered by the car's tires and could return fire. He'd gotten the door open when he realized that he hadn't shifted the car into park and it was slowly rolling backward and around toward the roadside ditch. Shit, shit! He lifted his left leg and poked at the shift lever, which was mounted on the steering column, trying to shift the truck into park. He missed, but managed to knock the lever upward, which shifted the truck into reverse, and the slow roll accelerated, and the car backed itself into the roadside ditch, where it bounced and tilted, and finally shuddered to a stop. The gunfire had ended, but his phone was ringing. Lucas risked a peek through the shattered windshield, saw nobody on the road, nobody in front of the truck. He sat up and pushed the park button on the shift lever and crawled out the passenger side door and dropped into the ditch behind the truck. He could neither see nor hear anyone moving along the road or through the roadside brush. He edged around to the back of the truck and looked up the road. The blue rim of the Toyota was gone. His phone had stopped ringing, but then started again. He answered as he surveyed his own truck. He was deep enough in the ditch that he doubted he could get out without help. Into the phone he said, "Yeah, Davenport. This is Aaron Clark. I'm a deputy sheriff in Limestone County, Alabama. We got a call." Lucas broke in. "I've been in a gunfight at the Sturgill Darling Farm off 132. The shooters went west on 132, maybe a half mile, then turned up a hill on a dirt road before they knocked me off the road into a ditch. I can't get out. They're driving a blue Toyota that's probably full of bullet holes. There are two of them, and they've got at least one automatic weapon." Lucas described the woman and asked that the deputy send a wrecker to get him out of the ditch. The truck was leaning sideways, and he was afraid it would roll if he tried to move it himself. "I'm going to run back to the Darling farm, make sure Mrs. Darling is okay. We'll have somebody meet you there," Clark said, "and we'll get on that Toyota." When he was off the phone, Lucas moved back into the brush and snuck up the hill, looking for the blue car or any movement. He saw none. The car was gone. His face was burning, he'd been vaguely aware of it, but now blood ran down into one eye, and when he wiped it away, his hand came back bloody from the heel to his fingertips, and he realized that he'd been cut up by shrapnel and glass, but hadn't felt it in the crush of the gunfight and chase. He turned and started jogging back toward the Darling farm. 6 or 7 minutes later, he was on the porch and shouted, "Mrs. Darling, the marshal, I'm coming in." He heard a muffled call from the back, and then Janice Darling appeared, holding the shotgun like she knew how to use it. She gaped at him. "Oh, my God! What happened? You're bleeding. Are you shot?" "Cut up, I think. We should have some cops coming in. If I could use your bathroom..." She led him to a small bathroom and peered into the mirror. He was bleeding from a half-dozen puncture wounds on his scalp, forehead, left ear, and the left side of his neck, and could feel more cuts down his back. He took off his jacket. There was blood, but not much, and several small bloody patches on the back of his shirt. One thing was for sure. His $2,000 suit was ruined.
"You need a hospital," Darling said.
"Yeah, but it looks worse than it is."
"You hope. Let me get a washcloth."
"Better not. I've probably got some glass in me. Better let a doc take it out. If I rub on it, I might push it in further.
She put down the shotgun, looked shocked, worried, and maybe softened up by the blood. So Lucas popped the question, "Is your husband really gone?"
"He was out of here at dawn," she said with a blink of an eye.
"He's gonna be darn upset when he gets back and sees what happened to the house."
"Well, maybe he'll call from the highway somewhere and you can tell him about it," Lucas said.
She said, "Maybe." She didn't look even slightly embarrassed.
Lucas couldn't think of anything else to say, so while they waited for the local cops, he excused himself to call Fort in Washington and told him what had happened.
"How bad are you hurt?" Fort asked. "On a scale of 1 to 10.
"No more than a 1, maybe less. I'll have to stop by an ER somewhere and get patched up, but not that bad."
"Okay, listen. I'm not gonna let you run around out there alone anymore. I've talked to SOG. We're sending a couple more deputies out there, Bob and Ray. Where do you want to meet?"
"I'll have to call you when I find out how bad my car is screwed up, but I'm thinking Nashville, depending on what happens with running down these cartel people."
"Call me every 5 minutes and tell me what's happening," Fort said.
Bob and Ray. Wasn't that a comedy team or something on the radio back years ago?
"Yeah, maybe. But these two aren't funny," Fort said. "Call me when you know where you'll be."
A sheriff's car rolled up the driveway a minute later, and Lucas and Janice Darling went out to meet the deputy, who introduced himself as Glenn Long. When he was sure Lucas wasn't bleeding from any major wounds, Long said,
"I'll ride you back into the hospital and get you fixed up. We haven't seen hide nor hair of that Toyota, though."
"We can't leave Mrs. Darling where these guys could find her if they come back."
"I've got a sister with a different last name across the line in Tennessee," Darling said. "I'll pack right up now and stay with her until it blows over."
The deputy said they would put a car in her driveway until she was gone, and he asked, "Where's Sturgill?"
"Gone to Canada," she said.
Her eyes flicked to Lucas.
"We're hoping he'll think to call back before he gets there, but you know Sturgill. Once he starts rolling, he just keeps going. Probably won't stop before he gets to the border."
Lucas said, "Yeah, right." Another sheriff's car arrived, this one carrying the deputy Aaron Clark, who'd called Lucas during the fight.
"We've got the tow truck pulling your car out of the ditch. It's gonna take a while. They've got to edge it out sideways," Clark said. "If they try to pull it out straight, they think it'll roll."
"Not that I think it'll make much difference. I'd be surprised if it's not totaled. Every piece of sheet metal on the car has got at least one hole in it."
"You got to tell everybody to take care if they spot that Toyota," Lucas said. "These people will kill you, cops or not."
"Everybody knows," Clark said. "I don't know exactly how they got past us, if they did. Maybe they're hiding out in the woods somewhere. We had cars coming from all directions as soon as you called."
"Better start checking the local farms," Lucas said. "They could have pulled into one, hid the car in a barn. Wouldn't be good for the farm people."
Clark looked at him, then said, "Oh, shit, shit." He turned and ran back to his car, got on the radio. Darling asked, "You think?"
"I worry," Lucas said.
Lucas was eventually hauled back to his truck by a sheriff's deputy. The Benz was sitting up on the road again where the wrecker driver was getting ready to pull it up on the wrecker's flatbed. The deputy walked around the truck shaking his head, and the driver said,
"I gotta tell y'all, pulling it out of there sideways didn't do the truck any good. But there was no other way to do it. If I tried to pull it straight out, forward or backward, she was gonna roll, and then, well, it wouldn't have been good for nothing but parts."
"My best guess, that's about all it is right now," the deputy said.
The driver nodded.
probably right. All them bullet holes don't help.
Lucas removed everything removable from the truck and then was taken to a local hospital where a nimble-fingered nurse pulled two tiny slivers of glass out of his neck and back. None of the wounds required stitches, but he would, the nurse said, itch for a few days.
I've been there, Lucas said.
While she worked on him, he called around, arranged for his truck to be hauled to a Mercedes dealer in Nashville, and called State Farm to report the accident. When the nurse was done, he got a change of clothes from his suitcase, went into the ER restroom, and put on the fresh clothes. He threw his cut and blood-soaked suit into the hospital trash. The blue car wasn't found that afternoon or evening, nor did the sheriff's office find any dead farmers.
Sturgill Darling had watched the gunfight from the barn.
He'd been listening on the open phone as Lucas talked to Janice Darling and knew that Lucas was a federal marshal. When the cartel crew showed up, he'd watched, ready to intervene if the marshal had been shot down and the cartel people had gone after Janice. When the marshal ran to his truck and went after the blue car, Janice had come out of the bathroom and asked on the phone, "You still there?"
"Still here. They're all gone, but they'll be back. Probably the marshal with some deputy sheriffs. Are you okay?"
"I'm fine, but the house is a mess. What are you gonna do?"
"I'm gonna hide right here in the barn. They've got no reason to search the place, and if they do look, I'll get up under the eaves where they won't find me. I'll get out of here after dark. You go on up to your sister's place."
"Okay. You be careful, Sturge."
"I will. Now you go on back to the bathroom like the marshal told you. I'll watch everything from here."
When Lucas got out of the hospital, he spent a half hour typing up a report of the shootout at the sheriff's office and sent a copy of it by email to Fort in Washington. A sheriff's deputy drove him across the Tennessee line, where he was picked up by a Tennessee Highway Patrol car and driven into Nashville to the Mercedes dealer, where he was told that a State Farm adjuster would be around the next day to assess the damage.
"He says he'll be here at noon," the service guy said. He was looking at Lucas's truck and shaking his head. 70,000 miles and all those bullet holes plus the interior damage and the mess under the hood. It's totaled, man. Might save the tires."
The amiable highway patrolman took him to the Hertz location at the airport. Lucas called Weather on the way to tell her what had happened. She was pissed, but didn't exactly say, "I told you so." She said,
"Be more careful. I keep telling you."
"I'm trying, and I got some help coming. They're sending down a couple heavies from the Special Operations Group. Sounds like the federal government's equivalent of Jenkins and Shrake."
"Good, that's good. You need the help, Lucas. For God's sakes, be careful."
Lucas got a Nissan Armada from Hertz and checked into an Embassy Suites hotel in downtown Nashville a few minutes after midnight and slept soundly, with the help of Tylenol with codeine, except for a few flashbacks to the gunfight, until 10 o'clock the next morning. At 10 o'clock, he was awakened by a heavy-handed pounding on the hotel room door. Chapter 12. Lucas pulled on his pants and went to the door, left the guard latch attached, and peered out through the crack. A short but wide man stood outside, dressed in black high-rise jeans, a white dress shirt, and a black nylon jacket. He had buzz-cut hair and a flattened nose and muscles everywhere. Behind him stood a much taller black woman, nearly as tall as Lucas, whose height was enhanced by an afro of 1960s dimension. She had a sharply chiseled face with a fingernail-sized scar on her left cheek. She was dressed in a blue shirt, tight black jeans, black suede ankle boots, and a black nylon jacket. Lucas asked,
"Who are you?" the wide man said. Bob and Ray, we were told you expected us.
Bob and Ray? He'd been expecting the Marshals Service equivalent of Jenkins and Shrake, the BCA's designated thugs. Bob fit, but Ray, not so much. Yeah, I'm not really quite up, but, come on in, I guess.
He unlatched the door and let them in.
Late sleeper, huh? Ray said as she came through the door. You know what they say about birds and worms.
Most birds haven't had the shit shot out of them when they get up early, Lucas said.
Heard it was mostly superficial, Bob said.
Whoever told you that probably never had the shit shot out of them, Lucas said. Ray was looking around the small suite and said,
How'd you get authorized for a palace like this one?
I didn't ask, Lucas said. Bob shook his head.
There's a rookie mistake. If you've made any more, feel free to tell us about them so we'll know what we're up against.
Lucas yawned and stretched, said, Well, after 2 days in town, I've made more progress toward finding Garvin Poole than the whole fucking Marshals Service did when it had him on the top 15 list for 5 years. That ought to be good for something.
Ray shrugged. All we heard is that you broke your car and didn't catch the people who broke it.
Lucas, maybe you ought to wait in the lobby.
That's no way to treat a brother marshal, Bob said. Why don't you go brush your teeth? I'm getting some bad breath over here.
Lucas went to the interior half of the suite, closed the door, shaved, showered, checked to make sure none of his cuts had started bleeding again, then put on a dark blue dress shirt, a medium blue Givenchy suit, and George Cleverly Oxfords, which he buffed up. When he emerged from the back room, Ray checked him out and said,
I'm going back home. Can't compete with this shit. Bet he can't get his gun out as fast as we do, Bob said.
That's why I hired you guys, Lucas said. I'm basically the brains behind the operation. You're the muscle.
Muscle my ass, Ray said. We're the Einsteins of the Marshals Service. Let's get some pancakes and figure out what we're doing today.
She knew Nashville and had a particular pancake house in mind, and Lucas followed them over in the Nissan. On the way, he called the Mercedes dealer in St. Paul and ordered a new SUV. The salesman said,
I can get you a loaded GLS 550 in 2 days in any color you want, as long as it's black. If you can wait a couple of weeks, I could get some other color.
I'll take the black one. I'm out of town right now. Get the paper ready. I don't want to hang around there any longer than I have to.
Got a bunch of new Porsches in, big guy, the sales guy said. I could put you in a Cayenne Turbo S that would eat the 550 alive any way you run it. Straight line, curves, off the line.
Shut up, Dick. Get me the papers for the 550.
The Porsche's in carmine red. Commit now and I'll give you 5,000 off. No, wait, did I say 5,000? I meant 7,000.
Listen, Dick, I don't need some snowflake SUV with 2 inches of road clearance. Get me the goddamn 550. I'll see you in the next week or so.
How many miles you got on the trade?
Dick asked. The trade expired yesterday, Lucas said. State Farm is giving me cash, but not enough. There's no trade.
Then what are you driving?
A Nissan Armada.
Oh, my God, I wouldn't leave my driveway in one of those things.
It seems sturdy, Lucas said.
Probably is sturdy. It's big enough you could land an F-16 on the roof, Dick said. It's just that I'd die of embarrassment.
I don't want to talk about it, Lucas said. Get me the 550. At the pancake house, Lucas and Ray Givens, ordered blueberry pancakes, while Bob Matisse, ordered waffles because, he said, they were less fattening.
Probably would be, Ray said, if you didn't put an ice cream scoop full of butter on top of them.
And then drown them in fake maple syrup, Lucas added. Bob said pleasantly, Fuck you. He poured more syrup and said to Lucas, As I understand it, you're an ex-state cop and you saved Michaela Bowden at the Iowa State Fair and she wired you up to get a special appointment to the service. Is that right? Can you introduce us to Bowden? I've got a few things I'd like to tell her. Like what? Like she's gonna lose if she doesn't start hustling her ass around the Midwest. Lucas pointed a fork at him. Every poll in the country says you're full of shit. Not every poll. L.A. Times says she's gonna lose, Bob said. They're right, unless she starts hustling her ass around the Midwest. Why the hell does she go to states that she's sure to lose, like Arizona and Texas, or that she's sure to win, like New York and California? What the hell is she doing in California? There's gotta be a reason. They gotta know more than we do. They're political pros, Lucas said. He looked at Ray. What do you think? I think she's gonna win. But Bob's smarter than he looks. Actually, given the way he looks, he's way smarter. He's got me worried. So what about your appointment? Bob asked. What about Bowden? Lucas told them about his appointment, and Bob and Ray gave him some background on their own work. They were both career deputy marshals assigned to the Marshals Service's Special Operations Group, which tracked and busted federal fugitives. They were a cross between an investigative unit and a SWAT squad, and, as Bob said, we got more guns and armor in our truck than a Humvee in Iraq. Neither one of them was married. Both had a divorce in the background, and Ray's ex-husband had custody of their two kids while she was out of town. She got them back when she was home. It works, she said. My ex is a good guy, as guys go, so I don't have to worry. He is a good guy, Bob said. He tipped his head toward his partner. They got a divorce because Ray, well, Ray isn't. Glad to hear it, Lucas said. Now, said Bob, tell me if this is right. You've never really had a clue about where Poole is, but you've been interviewing his relatives, and some of them turned up dead, and one other lady got her leg sawn upon. Lucas, I also located the guy who might be the spotter who took Poole to the counting house. He told them about Sturgill Darling and the shootout at the Darling farm, Darling's alleged history with Poole, and how Darling's wife said he was on his way to Canada without a cell phone to shoot a bear. Sounds like she was lying through her teeth, Ray said. With that kind of insight, you could become a St. Paul detective someday, Lucas said. Here's the thing. It's possible that Darling has a burner phone. It's also possible that he doesn't. Most of these guys don't keep them after they use them, which is the whole point of having a burner. We know that, Ray said. Lucas continued. While I'm overdoing the paperwork on my truck, I'd like you guys to do two things. Check with Verizon and AT&T and any other phone services that cover Darling's farm area and find out if he has a cell phone. If he does, we'll call it, see where he is. With any luck, he's planning to hook up with Poole. Or maybe he's just running. If he's just running, you guys can chase him down and squeeze him. What if he really doesn't have a phone? Bob asked. He was already gone when I got to the farm. I suspect he got a call from John Steiner, my source down in Florida, and took off. But I don't think he'd do that and leave his wife behind. I think he probably fixed it with his wife to hide out herself, but she hadn't quite left yet. If Steiner is the one who tipped him, Darling probably took off the night before I got there, or maybe early yesterday morning. If that's what happened, then he may well have called Poole. He wouldn't have done that on his cell phone. He'd know that we could figure that out. If he had a burner, he could have called on that. But if he didn't have a burner already in his pocket, he might have gone into this small town where the farm is and made the call from a payphone, if there is a payphone. You want us to figure out if there's a payphone and check the calls out of it in the last couple of days, Ray said. Exactly, Lucas said. Bob looked at Ray and said, All of that should take us, what, an hour? We could meet back here for lunch, Lucas said. I'm serious, Bob said. So am I. This is the kind of shit the FBI has down pat. I've got a line straight to the guy we need to talk to. We'll make a call and see you back here at noon.
Lucas looked down at his plate, still half full of soggy pancakes, and said, Tell you what, find a decent restaurant and I'll pick up the check.
Soto had had a brainstorm. He wanted to know about the cop who was tracking Poole because they were running out of leads themselves, but maybe the cop wasn't. If they couldn't find Poole, maybe the cop could. Where would they find the cop? At the Mercedes dealer, of course. The only one around. Because the cop in the Benz would recognize Court but might not recognize him, Soto left Court in a shopping center and walked across a divided highway to the only Mercedes dealer in Nashville and cruised the parking lot as though looking at the cars. He spotted a black Mercedes-Benz SUV parked behind the building and wandered past it. He didn't have to get too close before he knew he had the right truck. There were no other SUVs that had been shot to pieces with a machine gun. A thin, balding man in tan slacks and a blue sport coat was examining the truck and making notes on a clipboard. Soto walked past it, checked the license plate and the state. Minnesota? What was up with that? If the guy really was a cop, what was he doing in Tennessee? His phone chirped and Soto answered and Court said, Get out of there. The cop just walked in the front of the store. Soto hurried away, cut through a line of cars and recrossed the street.
I saw the car, got the tag, he told Court. Let's see what we've got.
They called the college-sounding guy. Soto said,
I need a license tag run from Minnesota. When we get a name, we need to check the name out, see who he is.
The college-sounding guy crunched on something that might have been a Cheeto and said, 200.
Bill us, as usual.
Call you back in 15 minutes, the college-sounding guy said. Soto imagined he was tall, soft, wore glasses, and combed his heavily gelled hair straight back from his forehead. And he had pimples and was surrounded by sacks of Cheetos. How he got wired up with the people in Honduras would remain a mystery. Court and Soto sat and waited. Court said,
My buttocks. I don't want to hear any more about your ass, Soto snarled. It's my ass, my ass, my ass, all the time, my ass. I know your ass hurts. Now shut up.
You're such a motherfucker, Court said. I'd like to get 10 minutes with you and my sawzall. Soto looked at her with interest. This was something new.
Really? You really want to cut me up? I'll tell you what, Beach. You look at me sideways.
A switchblade appeared in one hand, and the serrated blade flicked out.
I cut your fucking nose off.
Yeah, There's the cop. Lucas walked out of the Mercedes dealership and around to the back where his car was and out of sight.
Not gonna fix that wreck, Soto said.
He sounded proud of himself.
He's out of sight. I gotta get out of this car, Court said.
The pain wasn't so bad when she was standing up. She waited outside the car, partially concealed by a bush, and thought about Soto and what a miserable jackass he was. Here she was, really hurt because of his failing. His job had been to check the house, and instead he'd let a kid get the drop on them, like the worst fucking amateur in the world. Jackass. 5 minutes after Court got out of the car, Soto's phone rang, and the college-sounding guy said,
What you've got there is a federal marshal named Lucas Davenport. New on the federal job, but a longtime cop in Minnesota with a history of killing people. He is not somebody to toy with.
To what with? Toy with, mess with, the college-sounding guy said. Can you look at airline tickets? Sure, but if you want some ongoing monitoring for Lucas Davenport, it'll cost you $1,000 a day. I'll have to check every 15 minutes or so if you want some warning on when he's flying, if he does. That's a full-time job, but if you want that, I can give you enough warning that you could get to the airport yourself. I could even make reservations for you.
I don't care about that so much as where he's going, Soto said. If he goes, I'd like to know what kind of car he rents when he gets there.
In that case, I'll monitor flights for $200 per day. That'll get you a check every couple of hours until he flies. Another $200 for the car, make, model, and tag. I also got a special today only for our better customers. If he has a phone from AT&T or Verizon, I can hack into the company's GPS location server and tell you where his phone's at any given time. Soto.
You can do that?
For $100 per check, as many checks as you want, but $100 each.
Do that and bill us, Soto said.
You're on the clock starting now, the college-sounding guy said, and he hung up. When Court got back in the car, Soto told her about the call.
That there's a guy worth knowing, he said.
Sounds like a ratchet asshole frat boy to me, Court said.
She shifted uncomfortably in her seat.
I need to get a doctor to look at my buttocks. I think it hurts worse now than it did yesterday.
I can make a call down south, and maybe they have a guy, but it also might make them unhappy to know you've been shot.
Court didn't say anything for a bit. Then,
let's see what it's like tomorrow.
The thin, balding man from State Farm told Lucas that the Benz was totaled.
70,000 miles and not a decent piece of metal on it. Not even the roof, he said. The interior's trashed, plus the engine compartment looks like somebody was pounding on it with a ball-peen hammer, and the mag wheels look like somebody used a chainsaw on them.
Just tell me how much, Lucas said. The adjuster told him, and the recommended payoff was far too low. Lucas threatened legal action, and the adjuster couldn't quite hide a yawn. He refused to adjust the adjustment and told Lucas his insurance rates would probably be going up, given the nature of the claim, which involved all those bullet holes. Lucas was still pissed when he walked into the restaurant where Bob and Ray had taken a booth. They were eating salads. "Tell me something good," Lucas said as he slid in next to Ray.
There's one payphone in Elkmont, and at 6 o'clock, the day before yesterday, somebody made a call to Dallas. That was the only outgoing long-distance call from that phone that day, Ray said.
Pools in Dallas, Lucas said. That's about the time Steiner would have called Darling, and Darling went right into town and called Pool.
Maybe, Ray said.
Darling does have a cell phone. Mrs. Darling was lying to you. But it's not up on any network right now. He pulled the battery and probably has a burner by now.
So we don't know if he's running on his own, going to Canada to shoot a bear, or hooking up with Pool, Lucas said.
Bob said, if he is in Dallas, we're taking all the credit for finding him, me and Ray.
If you give me partial credit, I'll tell you what the next step is, Lucas said.
They watched him for a minute, then Ray said,
what you got?
What I have is a name in Dallas. I pulled all the paper I could find on Pool, and there are two guys he worked with, seem to have been friends, who are not in prison or dead, Lucas said. One is Derek Donald Arnold, and I have a Dallas address for him. The other is a guy named Rufus Carl Cake, who lives in New Orleans. We need to talk to Arnold right away. Arnold had a history of violence, according to Lucas's paper. Brawling when he was younger, jobs as a bouncer at a couple of strip clubs. He'd been busted twice and served time for strong-arm robbery, and once was arrested but released without prosecution while working as a boat unloader for a marijuana ring in New Orleans. In his association with Poole, he'd apparently worked as an intimidator and the guy who carried heavy stuff.
"He's a shooter?" Bob asked.
On two of his arrests, they took shotguns out of his cars. Not bird guns, but tactical pumps loaded with buckshot. No hard evidence that he ever used them.
"What's he doing now?"
Ray asked. "Don't know," Lucas said. "No law enforcement contacts for the last 3 years except for a speeding ticket." The cop who stopped him ran him and, based on his record, asked to search his car. Arnold agreed. Nothing was found. Doesn't look like he's ever spent much time in straight jobs, though. If we jack him up and find something, anything, we can use that as a hammer. Texas has a three-strikes law.
"I know a lot of people in the Dallas area," Bob said. "They could help if we need it."
"Good. Let's check him ourselves before we do that," Lucas said. "I don't want to misfire on something and have Poole warned off."
"What about Cake?" Ray asked.
"I know New Orleans." "We'll check him for sure, if we don't get a hit with Arnold," Lucas said. "Bob, what you've got is one name in Dallas?" Lucas said, "No. I also know that before he disappeared, Poole was converting everything he had to gold coins. He supposedly was going to run to Central America or somewhere."
"Where does that get us?" Ray asked.
"If he didn't leave the country, and if he hasn't been working, he's probably been cashing those coins to support himself. When we get to Dallas, first thing we do is check every gold-buying store in the area, see if they know his face."
"There's 7 million people in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex," Ray said. "He'll be a needle in a haystack."
"But if he's there, at least we'll have the right haystack," Lucas said. "That's when we go after Arnold." Lucas called Washington and talked to Fort, told him about the Dallas connection, and got tickets on a flight into Dallas that afternoon with rental cars and reservations at another suites hotel. They were still sitting in the restaurant, and when he got off the phone, Bob asked,
"How do you do that, man? We never stay in suites."
"Bowden connection," Lucas said. "Everybody's feeling their way along, trying to figure out how tight we are. In the meantime, I get perks. If they ever find out we're not that tight, it's back to the Holiday Inn."
"What time are we leaving?" Ray asked.
4:00.
"Probably ought to head out to the airport after we finish eating," Bob said. "Takes us a little extra time to get on the planes. We're flying with all that ordnance."
They packed up and headed for the airport, Lucas with one bag, Bob and Ray with one bag each, plus a large wire-reinforced duffel full of guns and armor. They reconvened on the flight side of security at 3:00. Ray said,
"Our tickets are business class."
"Yeah," Lucas shrugged. Bob looked at Ray, then said to Lucas,
"Boy, oh boy, you're my new hero, Davenport. Anytime you need help, call us, and if you only need one of us, call me, fuck Ray."
"Goddamn short people," Ray said. Chapter 13. Late afternoon, after a brief flight from Nashville, Dallas was hot, bright sunny, vibrating with stress, cars in a hurry. Not a southern city as much as a southwestern one. Lucas resisted the inclination to kiss the earth when he got off the plane. Got another Jeep, but a bigger one this time. The truck seemed okay, though he got lost getting out of DFW. When he finally got to the hotel, he found he'd arrived before the other two and checked in for all three of them, took his bag up to his room, and went down to the lobby to wait. Ray arrived 10 minutes later in a Camry, explained that Bob had gotten lost getting out of DFW and would be a few minutes behind her. Ray hauled her bags up to her room, and then Bob showed up in another Camry, shaking his head.
"Tell me you didn't get lost at the airport."
"Can't tell you that," Lucas said, handing over the key card.
I'm in 505. Let's meet there. I'll call Ray. When they were together again in Lucas's room, Lucas showed them the list of gold buyers he had downloaded from the net. They split the list three ways and, 10 minutes later, were on their way out. Ray had the closest one and called Lucas before he had the chance to get to his first stop.
We got a solid hit. They say he doesn't look exactly like the mugshot anymore. He's older and heavier, but it's him. He comes in once a month or so and cashes a coin, or sometimes two. He was last in a month ago.
Excellent. Call Bob. Tell him. Let's visit a couple more stores, but I think we got him.
Lucas stopped at a place called Arlington Precious Metal Exchange and Pawn, a storefront with dusty windows and a tangle of used power tools behind the glass. Inside, he walked past a lot of damaged musical instruments and obsolete film cameras to a guy who was leaning on a counter, smoking a cigarette and reading a free newspaper. The guy had looked up when the doorbell jangled, and when Lucas got to him, said,
"You're a very well-dressed police officer."
"Thank you."
"Well-dressed police officers make me nervous," the man said.
He was wearing cargo shorts with a weight in one leg pocket that Lucas suspected was a pistol, and a Tommy Bahama shirt with palm trees.
"I haven't done anything, have I? I stay straight with the local cops. You're not local, are you?"
"No, I'm a U.S. Marshal," Lucas said, the phrase still sounding odd to his ear. He took an 8x10 copy of Poole's decade-old mugshot from his jacket pocket and asked, "Does this guy cash coins here?" The man looked at the photo and said,
"Yeah, he does. He looks a little older now. Got a 3-day beard most of the time with some gray in it. Don't tell him I talked to you."
"Feels like a threat?"
"Yeah. First time he came in here, he had one coin with him," the man said. "I made him an offer. I didn't know him from Adam, so the offer was a little low. He said, 'Don't fuck with me, bro,' and I looked him in the eye and decided not to fuck with him. You meet a few guys like that in this business."
"When was the last time he was in?"
The guy scratched his neck, then said, "Maybe a month ago. Maybe more. He's about due. Usually comes in every month or 6 weeks. I make about $20 a visit, so, you know, I don't mind seeing him. But I ain't holding my breath either. He's not gonna make or break the monthly nut."
"Any idea where he lives?" Lucas said.
"Nope. I gotta tell you, sir, he didn't strike me as a person you want to be curious about. You notice I ain't asking what he's done. Don't bother to tell me."
Lucas took out a business card and handed it over. "Call me if he comes in. He'll never know."
"Sure," the man said, in a way that suggested he wouldn't be calling.
"You don't want to not call us," Lucas said. "You really don't want to be any kind of accessory. Not with this guy."
"Okay."
A little plastic stand sat next to the shop's cash register with a deck of business cards on it. Lucas took one, read it, asked,
"You're Deke?"
"That's me."
"Thanks for the help, Deke," Lucas said. "I'll call you every once in a while."
Bob found the same thing that Lucas and Ray had. They checked 9 stores between the three of them, and 7 store operators remembered buying gold coins from Poole. Bob and Ray each found one store where the operators said they didn't remember Poole, but in both cases neither was the store owner-manager. Nobody knew where he lived. Back at the hotel, they agreed that they'd found the city where Poole had been living, but he hadn't been to any of the stores